I'm Dr. Omar Khan.
I'm Dr. Shannon Gowland.
I'm Dr. Tiffany Dersey. And welcome to Vet Sessions. Hello, and welcome back to Vet Sessions. My name is Dr. Tiffany Dersey, and I'm here today with one of my favorite veterinary nutritionists, Dr. Sarah Aboud. Dr. Sarah Aboud, how are you today?
I am doing great, Tiffany. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm super excited to be here.
I'm so pumped to have you on here because you're so enthusiastic about nutrition and you're such a fun person. So today, Dr. Sarah Aboud is here to talk about nutritional supplements. So veterinary supplements are so interesting because, I mean, you know, when you look at it from a human perspective, there's just so many different supplements that people, you know, vitamins, minerals, supplements, this, that, to build muscle, to, you know, make you stronger, to make you smarter. So I'm really excited about that. Now, before we dive into that and talk about supplements, Sarah, tell me about how is it that you decided to get into veterinary nutrition?
Oh, how did I decide to get into veterinary nutrition?
Yeah, and tell me about like your pathway to become here or to come here at the OVC.
Okay.
Team.
I wasn't expecting that question, but it's a good one.
Okay.
It takes me all the way back to when I was a youngster and I was shadowing a large animal veterinarian. And okay. I just loved the lifestyle of a large animal veterinarian. And so mm-hmm. that's what got me on my path to veterinary school. And then when I was done with veterinary school, I was like, what about an internship? So I found an internship that would accept me, and that was at the University of Minnesota, and it was large animal medicine and surgery. Mm-hmm. And there you had to work both on dairy cows and horses. And I didn't have very much experience with horses, but I was like, okay. And then I learned a lot. And even with pigs, it was a fantastic year. I loved it.
I did not know that you started off in large animal.
Yeah. I wanted to be a dairy vet.
Sure.
I didn't get there yet, but I loved everything about dairy cows. That's where I'd spent all my formative years, like all my teenage years with this large animal veterinarian. And so then when I got to graduate school after the internship, I was looking around for a residency, and there was a residency advertised as large and small animal nutrition.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, large animal nutrition, that is everything having to do with a dairy cow, right?
Sure,
in terms of
absolutely.
What she eats or what she can't eat, what she can. And I was
production,
like, this will be great. Now, yeah, I'll just do a little bit of small animal on the side, right? No big deal. And it turned out while I was there that more of the people in the small animal hospital where I went, and this is at the Ohio State University, more of the veterinarians and specialists and students wanted more help in the small animal area than in the large animal. So over time, I just kind of gravitated and got more and more experience in that area. But how did I get interested in nutrition? It was through dairy cows and their demands through lactation.
Yeah. Exciting. Makes sense.
They need so much attention. And they're amazing, like what they can do, right?
I mean, absolutely.
Look, they got all these microbes in their gut and they change things that we would never be able to eat, like coarse grasses and that sort of stuff. And they change it into milk, amino acids, you know, the whole thing.
Amazing. Yeah. Cows are amazing.
I know. So anyway, that's how I got to nutrition. And then how did I get here? Well, I have no one but Dr. Adjourne Verbrugge to thank because she decided to have a baby. And then that meant she had to go on maternity leave. And then that meant the hospital and the college had to find somebody to replace her. And who wants to come to Canada for 1 year? Not too many nutritionists did, but
true.
I did. I was at the right place at the right time. So that's how I got here. And
excellent.
That was in 2018. Now that baby that she had, he's like 4 years old.
That's right.
And so I had to go away. And when my contract was up at first, and then I got a new contract and I got to come back.
And now you're here, hopefully for a really long time.
I hope so.
So we're so excited. So the OVC Nutrition Service, and of course here at the OVC Primary Healthcare Center, we're so happy to have you a part of our team. And so before we get started, just a shout out to OVC Pet Trust. So this episode of Vet Sessions is generously sponsored by OVC Pet Trust. OVC Pet Trust was founded in 1986 at the Ontario Veterinary College, and it's Canada's first charitable fund dedicated to improving and advancing companion animal health and well-being. OVC Pet Trust supports innovative discoveries, education, and healthcare that improve the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of diseases of pets. You can learn more about OVC Pet Trust at www.pettrust.ca or connect with them on Instagram at the handle @OVC Pet Trust. Thank you, Pet Trust. Okay, so let's dive in. So we were talking, you know, about what we wanted to do on this podcast. And of course, being at the OVC Fitness and Rehab and OVC Primary Healthcare Center, lots of people ask about supplements. And it's a really complicated subject because there's just so many out there and it's hard to know what to tell people. So we thought we would sort of prioritize today. So tell me this, Sarah. So for our day one ready veterinary graduates, what would the OVC clinical nutrition team say are the top three supplements that they would want new DVMs to know about and be comfortable with prescribing?
It's a good question.
Top three.
The top three are going to be omega-3 fatty acids.
Yeah, okay.
Probiotics.
Okay.
And some sort of dietary fiber supplement.
Yeah, that's interesting, fiber, because I don't often think about that as a supplement. And I feel like, you know, you alluded to the cow and the microbiome, and I feel like everything these days is about the microbiome and gut health, and it relates to so many different things.
It's true. And what's interesting that, you know, we try to teach veterinary students, not everybody knows this, but when you look at the long list of required nutrients to make a complete and balanced dog or cat diet, mm-hmm. there is no minimum requirement for any kind of fiber in the diet.
Interesting.
Which means when you go back and you look at the scientific literature, like how did early animal scientists and nutritionists, how did they figure out what are the required nutrients? Well, they test a lot of them in healthy dogs and cats, and they find out, oh, we can raise a litter of puppies and kittens, and the bitch or the queen and mm-hmm. the puppies and the kittens have not had any fiber in their diet at all.
Interesting.
But when they also do other studies in which they say, well, let's do a compare and contrast, and we'll put some animals with some fiber and some without, those that get the fiber in their diet, they just do a little bit better.
Interesting. Right?
Because we know fiber is important for good gut health, regular, you know, motility and bowel movements and that sort of thing. So can you have a completely void, you know, a diet void of fiber and do okay? You can. But you can do better if you've got some fiber in there. And then some of our patients that have dysfunction of their intestinal tract, they really do need some support and help from fiber. And some therapeutic diets have it already in there, like we call that an enriched or an enhanced diet. But sometimes animals don't need to go on those veterinary therapeutic diets. They can actually be on an over-the-counter or a well-pet diet, and we can just add some fiber to it.
Interesting. And so so starting with the last one, dietary fiber, and then we can go back to the probiotics and the omega-3s. With dietary fiber, I mean, I do think it's interesting that you say that that's on your list now, especially because it's something that, I mean, we always talk about fiber in the human nutrition world. Certainly, you know, increased fiber and how it makes you feel full at times. And, you know, again, the whole, allowance for that insofar as the microbiome. But I don't think about adding that or ensuring that the diet that I recommend for my dog has enough fiber. So what would you say about that? How does a veterinarian either look at a bag of food and know there's enough fiber, or when would they say, hey, you know what, you need to add fiber? Any thoughts? Or that's a pretty loaded question.
There's two parts to that question. Yeah. And I'll just start with the first one. How can you look at a bag or a label and even assess if there's any fiber in there? And what I think the other terminology for fiber is complex carbohydrates.
Okay.
All right. And so a lot of people, you know, get kind of excited about carbohydrates, like that they're bad. And sometimes people say carbohydrates, well, that's just like filler in my pet's food. Mm. Because it does make you feel full, and some of it isn't always fully digestible. Right. So that's the part about complex carbohydrates that's important to appreciate, that there are what's called insoluble and soluble types of fibers. So soluble fibers are more digestible, and they're used in a different way from the bugs, the microbes in the gut. And the insoluble fibers are basically the things like, okay, the gut's not going to digest those. They're going to contribute to the bulk of the poop, you know, what comes out the back end. Mm-hmm. So when I look at a list of ingredients, I can see different kinds of plant materials, and I think, oh, that's probably adding some fiber. Or one kind of ingredient that sometimes people see and they don't like, it's peanut hulls.
Okay.
Right? The hull of a peanut shell. Mm-hmm. Well, that is absolutely a form of an insoluble fiber. So it's there for a purpose, and the purpose is not to fill up the animal and make them, you know, eat less. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really, it's in a small amount, and it's got a purpose to help for the intestinal tract.
Excellent. And so insofar as people coming in and saying, hey, you know, I've added in some dietary fiber, I can say that one example, I should say a couple examples, is one, a lot of times people say, hey, I've added some pumpkin or canned pumpkin to the diet for various reasons. And then the other one that I sometimes hear is that they add psyllium or like something like Metamucil or as such. Any comments about those two products?
And I'm so glad you brought both of those up because, okay. Yeah, I've comments about everything, but let's talk about
that.
Pumpkin and,
yeah.
Pumpkin and Metamucil or psyllium.
Yeah.
The first is that pumpkin is basically water, mm-hmm. right? Like a can of pumpkin. Or when someone says, I'm feeding my cat a couple tablespoons of canned pumpkin, I think, well, that's great. Your cat probably likes it. And the water is going to be good for your cat, right?
Okay.
But do I think that there is any significant amount of contribution to the cat's bowel movements? Probably not. Not if you really wanted to, supplement them, then you would reach for something like the psyllium powder, the psyllium fiber, because there's no water in that or very, very little. And that is a source of an insoluble fiber. So the comment, can people do the pumpkin? Sure, they can. They probably, to get the same effect with the same amount as psyllium, you'd have to feed a lot of pumpkin.
And is pumpkin soluble or insoluble?
It's mostly soluble.
Mostly soluble.
And largely that's because that canned pumpkin is, I don't know, 80, 85, 90% water.
Right.
Yeah.
So no harm, but it may not be doing what they think.
What you think it is. That's right.
Right, right.
And then the psyllium is concentrated, right? So a little bit will take you a long way, right?
Right.
You don't need very much. And we usually say, titrate to effect, meaning mm-hmm. we're going to start you out on a very small amount, and we're going to work up and work up and work up until we see the effect coming out the back end that we would like. But the very important cautious point about Metamucil is when you go to the site for a product like mm-hmm. Metamucil and you go look and see what is available, there are several different versions.
I have noticed that. And
some,
flavors. Yeah.
Yeah, flavors. One version is like sugar-free.
Right.
And there are others that say with natural sugars. And those that have sugar-free on the label might actually have some, additives that we really wouldn't want for our dogs and our cats.
Right.
So
very harmful.
So, yep. Pet owners and people who are, looking at those kinds of products. And let me back up and say this. There's also a couple of those Metamucil versions that have some other things added. And nutritionists, mm-hmm. basically, when they're making a recommendation for a supplement, they say, okay, you really don't want any other enhancements or additives in there. Just go and get the psyllium fiber. Don't have a flavor. Don't have anything else.
Yeah.
That's kind of important. And because in nutrition, we like to say dogs are not small people.
True.
And cats are not small dogs. Right. So we should not say, well, if I take this Metamucil,
okay.
This is okay for me.
Yeah.
I think my dog can or my cat can too. Like, well,
yeah,
no,
not
check
exactly.
with your family vet.
Well, I think what you're alluding to is the xylitol, right? So xylitol is a fake sugar that can be toxic or is toxic to dogs and cats.
Right.
So we have to be very careful about that. So,
that's right.
But I do know that some people will get the psyllium from like the bulk barn or something like that. And they get the bran husks, which are a natural source of psyllium.
Yeah. And here's, so you bring up something, purchasing things in bulk. And,
right.
and I would say, if your pet is basically healthy and you just want to try this, you should get a small amount
mm-hmm.
and you can try it for a short period of time. And you should decide, why am I doing this? And what is the value?
Mm-hmm.
Let's just say someone said, my dog is on a good diet. I like it, but about once a week, she has kind of a loose stool and I've been reading and I'm just going to add some psyllium and I'm going to go to the bulk store and I'm going to buy it that way. I would say this kind of dietary trial with one supplement should be short term
mm-hmm.
and you're looking at, can I improve the quality of my animal's stool?
Right.
But the thing about buying things in bulk is there's no label. There's no
right.
manufacturer. There's nobody to call if there's a problem. There's nothing. There's no way for
no
you
guidance.
To see, is there anything else that's been added to this? So if you want to try it in a healthy animal, it's short term. If you want to try it in a pet that's had a long-term medical problem or some chronic condition and you're hoping that you can really improve that, I would say choose a product that's got a label.
Sure.
That you
Makes
can,
sense.
Yeah, that you can follow up with the manufacturer if there's a concern or an issue.
Right. And we can talk about that in a minute, but just about, you know, like how do we choose nutraceuticals and where do we purchase them from? Because I know it can be very overwhelming. A lot of times what we'll do is when people are coming in for their wellness exams, customer service at the front will ask the client to take a picture of with their phone of all the foods and supplements that their dog or cat takes so that when they come to the appointment, we can better understand what they're taking. And some people, along with a balanced diet will also have, you know, 5 or 10 supplements on top of that. So it can be very confusing and it can be a lot. Yeah.
It can make for a long visit. Right?
It can make for a long visit. So, but you know, it's interesting because supplements are so available and I think, you know, we get so excited and I mean, you can buy them everywhere from Walmart to the drugstore to the pet store. So it's, they're kind of everywhere. So.
Yeah. I really like this idea though, that you ask your clients before they come in. And I think especially for like new veterinarians just starting out, this is a place to have a lot of information shared.
Right.
And it also gives you a sense of what kind of a pet owner am I dealing with? Where do they like to shop? Do they value this kind of thing? So that you have a little clue. Because if you felt like, you know what, they should just stop all of this right now for some reason. If you didn't understand where they're coming from, you could have some communication challenges.
Absolutely. So I think it's been very positive. And so we did have one time actually, because we asked for people to take pictures of their foods as well. You know, thinking potentially that they take a picture of the food bag, but they just took a picture of the kibble in the bowl. So cute. Yeah. Ooh, I can identify.
I don't know what that is.
Yeah. I don't know what that is. Maybe I should know. I don't know. So, okay, well let's talk more about, some of these, supplements. So we've talked a little bit about fiber. Tell me about probiotics, because I feel in this day and age that probiotics are really getting a big push. Like, let's do probiotics.
Yes, they are.
So why would we use probiotics? When would we use probiotics? What is the deal about probiotics?
And actually, it's not just probiotics. Mm-hmm. There's also something called prebiotics.
Oh, boy.
And now there's something else called symbiotics.
Oh, my.
And symbiotics are the combination of some pro and some prebiotics. And these products have been around for quite a while in the veterinary industry as well as in human medicine. And I am not, I can't say at all that I'm an expert in any way. I just know that there are lots of products and we need to do a good job of evaluating, you know, what we're going to recommend and understanding, you know, for which patient, which kind of product. I, as far as I can tell, of the few that I have done some research on, there isn't necessarily one best product for every single animal.
Right.
And so a probiotic has one or more organisms. Usually they are live and active so that they can, you know, enter into the intestinal tract and either reseed, you know, and help reestablish the microflora that are there or support the microflora that are there. And some companies will sell a product and it will only have one organism in it. And others will say, you know, we've got four, we've got three. And all these organisms typically are organisms that can be naturally found in healthy dogs or cats. So when an animal's unhealthy, like they have some gut disease or gut dysbiosis, right? There's a mismatch of the organisms that are in their gut. So we want to try to help and support. And there's a little bit of research. I'm not familiar with all of the research, but when probiotics first were becoming popular, and this was quite a while ago, some companies were doing research and they were trying to establish with some evidence under what conditions might having a probiotic on board be more beneficial than not having a probiotic.
Right.
And from what I can understand, the best evidence that's available shows, well, if you've got an animal with an acute diarrhea, then and you get some probiotic on board, you can see some benefit for them as opposed to the animal that's had a chronic case of diarrhea.
Okay.
To add and introduce some probiotic for them, we don't really have any substantial evidence that says, oh yeah, you should do that. And yet, because it's relatively speaking inexpensive and relatively innocuous, we don't give doses over and over again of probiotic and see animals get sick from it.
Right.
Right. So animals can be on some probiotic for a long period of time, but there's no easy way to assess, is that making any difference?
Right.
So what I see sometimes in our setting of critically ill animals or animals with chronic problems, I see that they get recommended all sorts of things, medications, and then going out the door, a change of diet. And oh, by the way, we'll just toss some probiotic in there. And
sure.
And I would advocate more like, why don't we get the animal home and through its convalescence, and then we could maybe think about adding the probiotic.
Interesting.
I haven't seen any research about this, but it doesn't appear, like, at least in the short term from my own observations, that
right.
on top of all the medications, on top of everything else, that here's some probiotic also, let's just throw that into the mix, and that's making any difference.
Sure. I think where we use it quite a bit in primary care is the acute diarrhea setting, right? So, puppy, dog, cat, whatever comes in with acute diarrhea. Way back when, veterinarians were probably pretty diligent at prescribing something called metronidazole, which is an antibiotic. And as we push towards more sort of antibiotic stewardship and we reduce the use of something like metronidazole, and I think there's some compelling studies to say that in acute settings that you might be better to reach for a probiotic. So I find that that's probably, in terms of where we use it, that's probably where we use it the most.
And a nice follow-up to that is just, okay, there was an acute case of diarrhea. We are going to prescribe this probiotic, but does the puppy need to be on it forever and ever?
Right.
Right? I mean, how do we decide? And again, of evidence, but it would seem to me like thinking about, well, there needs to be some window of convalescence. Mm-hmm. And I think convalescence happens for each animal individually. But we look at, well, how sick were they before, right?
Right.
And let's say after about a week at home, after its acute episode of diarrhea, a puppy now has, and the owner can report to your team, right? We've had 3 days in a row of regular bowel movements and everything looks great. I would say, okay, looks like we're coming out of convalescence. Doesn't mean we're completely out of it, but
right.
but that's 3 days of regular bowel movements seems very
pretty
appropriate
good.
as at least a way to think, all right, now that we're maybe at the tail end of convalescence, let's look at what all the treatments were and decide, could we stop the probiotic.
Absolutely. I think that's a great conversation. And so when you were saying organisms, just to clarify, the probiotics are typically bacteria. So we often say, we're adding more good bacteria and symbiosis, again, meaning that they can kind of work or synergistically together.
Yes.
Is that right?
And so how do you explain that to pet owners, I wonder, because there are good bacteria and not so good bacteria that reside side by side, right? All throughout the intestinal tract or in certain parts of the intestinal tract. So we want them there, but we want to make sure the environment is not such that the bad bacteria or less than good get to overflow, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then in terms of probiotics and dietary fiber, so probiotics, again, are sort of, more adding in more good bacteria, for lack of a better description. And dietary fiber can be considered a prebiotic.
Right.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah.
Because this always confused me, right? Because the prebiotic works at the back end.
Right.
In the colon. So
right.
It's like why don't we call that the postbiotic? I'm not sure.
Let's
anyway,
change it.
Yeah, we can. But it's going to get back there, and it's because it didn't get digested and absorbed anywhere else. And then there it is, ready for those organisms back there. And,
right.
And now they can break down some of that, and they can use it to make
energy
and they
can flourish.
That's right.
Yeah, so the prebiotic sort of helps the probiotics do their job and flourish.
Right.
Because I do see that there's combinations of probiotics with a prebiotic with something like psyllium in it. And a lot of people are prescribing that for acute diarrhea, fiber responsive diarrhea, that type of thing.
Yeah. And people are, it's a natural question. Well, why wouldn't I want both of those? What's the advantage? And I'm not sure that anybody really has, parsed that out and studied that in any kind of detail. So it still comes back to assessing each animal individually.
Absolutely.
Right? There's diarrhea. So let me try to understand, is it small bowel? Is it large bowel diarrhea?
Mm-hmm.
How can I support the gut as it heals?
Absolutely. Great. So next supplement. So going back to the first one on the list, omega-3 fatty acids. So certainly people ask about that a lot in terms of joint health and coat health and that type of thing. So it's something that often people may be taking even for themselves. So it's not uncommon for people to come into primary care or the rehab facility and say, hey, should my dog be on omega-3? Hey, can I give them the same one that I'm taking?
Yeah, and what do you say? I want to know
great.
What you say.
Okay, so this is my take on it. So from, you know, omega-3 fatty acids can be fantastic. And we know from research, and there's some pretty good, decent research there, that they're a very good supplement to help support joint health, more so than many other supplements that are on the market. So again, bang for your buck if you're going to buy some kind of supplement for joint health, arthritis, that type of thing, that omega-3s are pretty good. And that there are three different types of omega-3 fatty acids. So there's the EPA, there's the DHA, and there's the ALA. And I used to know how to say every one of those, but I can't, like the actual full name. So we'll just go with the abbreviations. And that dogs really can't metabolize ALA, which is kind of like flaxseed, very well. So right. There might be like some fiber in flaxseed, but in terms of like omega-3 fatty acids, they're probably not the best choice. Right. I think there's some research actually. So we'll see how that comes in. And so really you're looking for a combination of EPA and DHA, which are again types of omega-3 fatty acids. And those often are coming from fish sources. So fish oil, not exclusively. I think they can come from algae as well. Mm-hmm. So but fish oil predominantly, and that we know that they can help from an anti-inflammatory perspective in joint health.
Right. So that's what you tell people.
Yeah.
Sounds
what
good.
Do you think?
I like it.
Whew.
There's actually
tell me more.
Lots of other
okay.
omega fatty acids.
Okay.
But we
three
don't,
main.
Those are the three. Main
three that
ones.
Tiffany knows.
That's
yeah.
right.
Okay.
And that's okay.
So tell me about omega-3s.
So,
what in terms of, you know, people bringing that up in the exam room, what would you say? What would you tell them about omega-3s and when to use them?
There would be a couple different points I would make. One would be just like for a frame of reference that when pet food companies formulate diets, they have to include EPA and DHA for young growing puppies and kittens
right.
and adult cats. Those
right.
are those.
And
are
that's for brain development. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay.
Right. But they're not needed in you know, to make a complete and balanced adult dog food.
Okay.
They're not required.
Okay.
And yet, because they're so popular in human nutrition mm-hmm. and because they have been incorporated for many years now in veterinary therapeutic diets, like weight management diets,
right.
joint management diets, because they've been around, there's always pressure. Once they get into a veterinary therapeutic diet, there's pressure from veterinarians, there's pressures from pet owners that say, oh, I can't afford that veterinary therapeutic diet, but I'd really like it if you could put some of that EPA, DHA in the over-the-counter product.
Sure.
So that has been influencing, you know, manufacturers that don't make veterinary therapeutic diets. It also influences the manufacturers that make the veterinary therapeutic diets because they make over-the-counter diets
sure.
too. So we can find, for adult dogs, we can find fish oil or salmon oil in these foods on a somewhat regular basis now.
Absolutely. And I was going to say, when you look at the product guides, you know, again, even in terms of going to a pet store and you flip the bag from an advertising perspective, right? Like often it will say that, you know, it has fish oil or it has omega-3 fatty acids. Because again, I think that, you know, people are more aware of that as it pertains to, you know, joint health and
right.
brain health and puppies. And I mean, even, you know, kidney cats and kidney dogs were even using some omega-3s there.
So. Right. So that's the first point, is that it's not needed or required mm-hmm. in adult dog diets. But then we go into the literature and we find out, well, where is the research that's been done? And if we want to dose an animal or add it to the food, how do we know how much? And there's way more research that's been done in dogs and cats.
Okay.
And there isn't that much done in dogs. But there's a particular reference paper that many veterinary nutritionists use. And that paper's more than 10 years old, but it's got a small little table in it. And it says, right, for the dog with kidney disease, here's the dose.
Right.
For the dog with joint disease, here's the dose, you know, that sort of thing. So a few for the dog with cancer, here's the dose.
Right.
But what they don't have is they don't have anything for your middle-aged dog that's a little bit overweight and you want to try to prevent joint disease from happening, here's a preventative dose.
Okay.
Okay, there's no preventative dose. So
interesting.
So
what do
yeah,
yeah
what
how do
we
advise?
Do and how do we sure. how do we do that? Well,
sure.
Well, yes, if I could be
you refer to a nutritionist. No.
Yeah. yeah. Well, and even, you know, you know this, and I'm going to make a plug for the article that I wrote a couple of years ago with my colleague, Dr. Allison Wera.
I love your article. So and, tell us the name.
Oh, thanks. The journal is Advances in Small Animal Care.
Mm-hmm.
This was a 2020 publication, And the title of the article is Combining Nutrition and Physical Rehabilitation to Improve Health Outcomes for Dogs and Cats.
And it's a great article. I really love it. It's got some great description, very good pictures.
Rehab.
And I thought it was a really great discussion.
Tools to assess animals that are overweight. But as we were crafting that, and we did craft that during the pandemic, we needed to consult with other nutritionists to say, all right, where is the clinical experience of people who want to dose a dog, you know, for some omega fatty acids, and the dog's otherwise healthy, but we want to try to prevent joint disease.
Sure.
And so one of our colleagues who works at Cornell, who's a board certified nutritionist and also in sports rehabilitation.
Amazing.
Yeah. He said, well, this is the dose that we use. So anyway, we have that in the paper.
Okay.
Would you like
to tell us what the dose is?
I
think it's like you start off with 50 to 100 milligrams per kilogram.
Yes.
But for like more advanced cases, so for instance, if you have more advanced arthritis.
If you actually have arthritis.
Right, really bad arthritis, then you can try to top it up to get to the therapeutic value. But the therapeutic value is a little bit different because you take the ideal body weight and you have to calculate something called the
metabolic body weight.
So sometimes we call that capital B, capital W. So the BW. And so you have to take their ideal body weight, X to the power of Y, 0.75. And that's your metabolic body weight. And then you times that by 310 milligrams per kilogram.
Right.
So it's quite a bit more, actually. But we know that the toxic dose, or like you don't want to go too high, right, is about 370 milligrams of the BW.
And regarding the omega fatty acids, let's keep going.
Let's talk more. Something
else in this article that would be helpful to people.
Yeah.
And because there's a very important question, and that is, well, what if my patient already has a diet that looks like it's enriched or enhanced with omega fatty acids?
Great question.
Yeah. Will I need to add more? And generally speaking, if the animal is small in body stature and body weight, under 20 kilos, then whatever they're eating, if they're eating to meet their energy needs and that product has omega in it, omega-3s, they will probably be getting that appropriate dose.
Right.
But as soon as they start to get, you know, heavier, bigger, our large breed and giant breed dogs, they probably need something in addition to what's in the food.
Right.
And so we have an example in this particular paper, both of a cat and a dog, trying to calculate, well, if they ate a certain amount of food, and here are some options, how much would they need? And we also looked up, we did a lot of research for this particular article. We looked up a lot of options, and we used a valuable resource that I do want to talk about
how do we
choose supplements that we feel with some level of confidence, like they're going to be okay and they're not going to be problematic.
Well, and you know, it's such a great question because from a consumer perspective, you know, I go to buy a multivitamin or something like that. There's so many on the shelf and it's really hard to know. And when you look at it, as I understand in Canada and the States, they're not well regulated. And
so,
you know, quality is hard to assess. And so a lot of times you're having to sort of go to a brand that you trust. But what does that mean, right?
Right.
And so so what's your take on that? What would you say to people about, you know, where to buy their supplements or what supplement?
Yes. Well, for humans, one thing that I would advise people is to look for a little designation on their supplement label that says USP.
Mm-hmm.
USP stands for United States Pharmacopeia.
Okay.
And this is an organization that you can think of it like they're a third-party independent evaluator. So they go out and about in the world of supplements, and they take things off the shelf, and they take it into their laboratory, and they take it out of the container, and they say, oh, on the container, on the label, it says it's going to have this much of XYZ nutrient.
Right.
And then they analyze it, and they if it meets exactly what was on the label, if the contents are appropriate, they will put their little USP designation on the label.
Interesting. So meaning like if it said it had 100 milligrams, does it actually have 100 milligrams of the product that they said it has?
So when you said supplements are not well regulated, you know, bing, 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 you really hit it on the head. Like when we as consumers go and look at any kind of supplement anywhere, we have no way to tell by looking at the label. If it says it's got 100 milligrams in there, does it really?
Right.
Unless the company is telling us somehow, hey, we did a third party evaluation.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
And there's very few that have actually.
That's
interestingly.
Right.
Yes, a lot of people just, yeah. So it's kind of, from a consumer perspective, it's kind of stacked against us a little bit.
You're right. Mm-hmm. So USP is one okay. kind of designation, and I wish I could tell you that they also evaluate pet supplements, but they do not.
Right.
So that's for our friends eating human or taking human supplements. Mm-hmm. The other resource that many nutritionists use, and veterinarians can too, is called consumerlab.com.
Right.
This is not Consumer Reports. This is consumerlab.com. And it is also a third-party evaluator, but they have a subscription service. So it's not very much. It's less than $100. Mm-hmm. And for a year's subscription.
Okay.
And so if you were working in a busy practice where you regularly had people who were interested in supplements and you just felt like you wanted to have a good resource, then having the practice pay for a year subscription and you know, someone on the team uses it at least once a week to look up something,
right.
it would more than pay for itself because you would be guiding people appropriately.
Right.
So it is a resource in which they are evaluating both human supplements and pet supplements.
Okay.
And in the realm of human supplements, they will break them up into categories like vitamins and minerals, right? For adult men, for adult women, for children. And then at the very end, it's like, and we've done a few for pets too.
Yay. Yeah.
And they are looking, they're doing the same thing. They're looking inside the container okay. and they're measuring it. And they'll do a couple things actually. They will look and say, oh, on the label, it said 100 milligrams. Is that really what they have? And the other thing they'll do is they will measure for some potential contaminants. And by that, when they do a report, you can, it's usually these reports are many, many pages. So you've got a lot of background info and they'll kind of show you, you know, where have some studies been done. And then you get to the part of the tables where they have listed the products they analyzed lately and whether or not they approved or disapproved them,
right.
approved or not approved. And so you might go down the list and see something's not approved and you go, oh, why not? Oh, we only found 73% of the active, you know, nutrient that was supposed to be in there. And we found too much cadmium or mercury.
Right. Oh,
right.
Gosh.
So cadmium, mercury, and lead, those are the three. And so they have a very low acceptable level. And when if they measure something higher than that, they're notifying people. And again, if we just stand in the store, in the supplement store, and look at everything.
Yeah, like how would you know?
We won't know. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they also are really big on looking at the cost,
right.
the cost per okay. unit of how it's sold. So they'll often say, you know, here's our top pick is this. And it'll often be based on, well, it met all the criteria and it was the most effective for cost.
Okay. Now, the other thing that I have done is people like yourself, when I see what you're recommending, again, I try to tailor it to the pet, but I do look, you know, and I do look to good resources like the OVC Nutrition Service and say, you know, which products should we sell here in our clinic to OVC? And so sometimes, you know, somebody will come in with a bag full of supplements and I'll say, okay, so, you know, I do think that it's really valuable to, you know, supplement with an omega-3 fatty acid for your dog for this reason. However, I'm not familiar with the supplement that you just showed me and you took out of your bag. However, this is one that I do recommend and I do trust. And I wonder if you would consider this. So sometimes in a busy practice, as much as I would like to investigate further, there's so many supplements and even omega-3s, right? There's probably like thousands on the market. So sometimes it can be really complicated. You know, there are, you know, some, you know, human supplements that I'm more familiar with. So if somebody has an omega-3 that they're maybe taking themselves, I might be able to say, hey, this is okay. But I like your point about, you know, it's really important to find out what's in the, what they're feeding, because a lot of the foods, like, you know, commercial pet foods actually already have some omega-3s in there. So you got to get back to good old math and you have to calculate, well, how many are in a gram? And, you know, how many, like, you know, how much do we add on top? And we don't want to have too much because we don't want to get to a toxic dose. So it gets a little bit confusing. So one thing I actually like are the joint diets that have omega-3s in it. And they're kind of, a lot of them are have 50 to 100 milligrams per kilogram of the omega-3s in there. So that can be an easy way, because one thing that I learned, and you can tell me if I'm right, is that, you know, when you're supplementing on top with the omega-3s, because it's a fat, right? It's about 9 kcals per gram. And so that could be a lot in terms of weight loss for a pet, right? Added calories. So the nice thing is that if you do get a weight loss slash joint diet, then that is already accounted for in the total calories that you're feeding.
Yeah. So. Mm-hmm. Okay. So a couple of points in the article that I wrote with Dr. Wera, there are a couple of tables, one for cat and one for dog, in which we did all the research and looked at consumer labs and looked at these different omega-3 fatty acid products. And we chose only omega-3 fatty acid products that had nothing else added to them.
Okay.
Right, so that's one point I wanted to make.
Oh, right, because some of them, I remember learning this from your articles, that some could have vitamin A or vitamin D, or they can have other things
right.
in them,
they
right?
They can have so, other things that you, right, if you don't account for it, yeah.
Yeah, and then you could cause hypervitaminosis. So you're quite right that sometimes it can be helpful to say, hey, look, I'm not sure about the product that you have, so either consider a joint diet or consider, you know, one of the ones that I know about.
Yes.
So,
And the other thing is, if you are a busy practitioner and you don't have the time, you could always consult with some nutritionists. And,
absolutely.
And we could offer guidance, or we can do the research for you.
Sure.
And help you identify a few products that you can either add to your portfolio or help with an individual animal.
I think that's a great idea. And I think what I've learned is the value of referring to a veterinary nutritionist like yourself, because I do feel that it gets complicated. And like I said, I think everybody has great intentions for their own pets and really wants them to be healthy. They want them to live long. They want them to be happy. So I think their intentions are really good. But sometimes more does not necessarily mean better. And I think also if people have their pets already on a commercial balanced diet, that adding some of these things on top, like we were just talking about too much vitamins, like, you know, vitamin A and D and hypervitaminosis, they could be causing some problems, and they may not be intending that. So more is not better.
That's right. And in fact, even people who want to add an omega fatty acid, they may find that their animal doesn't tolerate it.
Right.
So
true.
So small amount,
small,
you know, you're talking earlier about that, that potential preventive dose that's low, and that's okay to start out low. You don't have to go high, especially
if
your animal's
healthy.
Well,
you might get like
healthy.
Blow it diarrhea.
Yeah, that's right.
So, well, and then the one area that I do understand that still is contraindicated is if you have a dog that has pancreatitis, then this may not be the great choice.
That's
so
right.
Certainly you always want to, and I think what I heard you say is that, you know, an individual plan for that pet. So, you know, again, I'm making a few blanket statements here. And so I think that it's really important that if this is something that you're considering, somebody who's listening, you want to, you know, tailor make, you know, the prebiotics, the probiotics, the omega-3 fatty acids to your particular pet, because it may or may not be indicated. Yeah.
And another really important point is just make one change at a time.
Right. Let's not
add a
bag of vitamins tomorrow and minerals and
Don't add all of it. And
sure.
So if someone was to come to me and say, I'd really like to try some of this, I'd say, all right, well, let's assess your animal. Let's make sure that the diet that your animal is on is not one that you want to change, and it's complete and balanced. Your animal's doing okay, maintaining a stable, steady body weight. And let's talk about what do you hope to achieve by having a supplement.
Right.
So probiotics for an acute diarrhea is a pretty good place to start.
Right.
Or even if you just said, my animal has loose stool. She has loose stool a couple times a month, and I think a fiber supplement might be helpful. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we have an outcome that we can easily measure. The owner can look and see, right? So there's one more point that I wanted to make, and that is sometimes we have clients who come to us and ask about a supplement or an herb or something we've never heard of.
Right.
And then we say, all right, well, we're going to need to go and do a little bit of research. So we need to take a little time to do that, but we find out where did they find out about it, what website, what product were they looking at. And then we go off, and the place where I start is usually with, you know, an internet search for some original research. So a PubMed kind of a search, or even Google Scholar.
Right.
And I'll start off with, you know, dog or cat, whichever the animal is presented, and the name of the supplement, and just try to find out, has anyone done any research in the species?
Right.
And most of the time that answer is no. Every once in a while we can, but most of the time we've maybe seen some research that's been done in rodents or in humans or another species. So we start there and we go, all right, we don't see anything in dogs or cats. Let me go now. I go to VIN, Veterinary Information Network.
Yeah, they're still pretty good.
I'll go into any one of the folders of that maybe is holistic veterinarians, internal medicine, nutrition, surgery. It kind of depends on why does the owner want to feed this particular supplement. But right. I'll go and I'll try to say, are these veterinarians aware of this? Mm-hmm. Is anybody using something? Can I find a dose? Can I find some friendly warnings? Oh no, don't do this and don't do that, right?
That's helpful.
Yeah, so I use VIN in that way, and then I'll go to Consumer Lab and I'll try to find an appropriate product that has been vetted, so to speak, right? That has been approved, and then I can come back to the owner and I can say, I did try to see if your supplement that you know, the brand that you brought,
right.
Was it in Consumer Lab? No, it wasn't. But here's two or three other options that might be suitable.
Right.
And then I give them the spiel about here's why I'm a fan of the Consumer Lab, because somebody's actually tested what was inside the bottle.
And I like that it's independent as well. So yeah, right. and not just what is in it, but what's maybe not so good in it as well.
Right.
So yeah,
I don't think any company can actually knock on the door of Consumer Lab and go, hey, will you test our, you know, they can't put it on their, they don't put it on their website. Like we got it tested.
Gotta wait till they find you.
Yeah. Wait till they find you.
Well, I think that's fantastic. So I think it's been so great talking about different supplements. I'm sure that there are thousands, if not millions more. But certainly I agree that these top three ones come up almost on a daily basis now. So so interesting. So I think you've given us some great tips on how to discuss this in the exam room, how to make it practical, and where to look up additional resources. And then, of course, always considering that if we need to, we've got our OVC nutrition service and people like yourselves that there are more and more actually board certified nutritionists that are in clinical areas now.
That's right.
In different clinics across Canada and the world, which is really exciting.
Yeah.
So thank you very much, Dr. Abboud, for coming on the podcast. I hope you come on again. There's
thank
so many
you.
Things nutrition that I have questions about. So, we hope to host you again. For our listeners, thank you very much for joining us today. If you have any ideas for future podcasts, please message us at Vet Sessions, and that's on Instagram. Or you can email us at vetsessions at hotmail.com. So vetsessions@hotmail.com or email and then Instagram at vetsessions. We will talk to you all again. And Dr. Sarah, we can't wait for you to come back on.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
You got it. Take care.